Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Philip Hensher on his latest novel, A Small Revolution in Germany. Philip Hensher has written 11 novels, including the Booker shortlisted The Northern Clemency, King of the Badgers, Scenes from an Early Life, which won the Ondaatje Prize in 2012, and The Friendly Ones, which you may remember we spoke about on, I think it was the 500th Little Atoms. He's Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Bath Spa, and Philip's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is A Small Revolution in Germany. Philip, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you, dear.
How would you describe this one, first of all?
Well, it's a story about growing up, and it's about politicians, really. It's about the sort of the small agreements that we make with our fate as we get older. It's so easy to kind of believe things passionately when you're 17, then you grow a little bit old and think, well, that's not really going to work, and I've got to get a job, I've got to live in society. All that kind of idealism really kind of starts to drift off. And I've always been quite interested by the ways in which we feel about our former, you know, passionate beliefs. And I thought I would write a novel that's, well, it was really inspired by meeting some people that I'd known 30 or 35 years ago who really hadn't changed the sort of radical idealistic beliefs that they had then. And I sort of walked around them. I was absolutely fascinated to see what it's like to, you know, stick to your principles for decades, really, because I don't think it happens to anybody else at all. So it was really about just about kind of getting older and what you think you believe changes, or in very rare cases it doesn't change, but the world is always going to change around you. That's the thing.
And in terms of why now, or I guess the period of time when you were writing this novel, because the world that our narrator Spike, who we're going to talk about in a minute, comes from 10 years ago would have just been completely esoteric and probably wouldn't have occurred to anybody to write about. But of course, then there was Corbyn, and I guess...
Well, yes, I guess so. I suppose it doesn't really... The book is about kind of far-left radicals in the 1980s and what happens to them. It was certainly something that became a little bit more urgent, and we probably became much more aware of these people through social media. Suddenly they had a platform. Suddenly we could see what they were talking about and what they believed and how they behaved. But I'm quite sympathetic towards these people, really. I think we kind of need to engage with these people. I'm not really sure what the initial impetus for writing this book was. I mean, it wasn't really to prove a point or anything like that, and I'm not really sure what I think at the end of writing the book, which is, you know, always is always the case. And I don't really know you know, whether we're supposed to be on one side or another. I guess my feeling is that it's not ideal to completely sell out those youthful idealistic beliefs, but it's not such a great idea to stick to them either. Looking at this generation emerging that really believes in kind of the impossible ideal again did spark me off a little bit. I think, you know, 15 years ago, that kind of idealism wasn't quite so noisy and as prominent as it is now. And certainly kind of looking at people like Greta Thunberg reminded me of all sorts of things about kind of what I was like when I was 16.
So let's talk about Spike then, our narrator. Who is he? What sort of world does he come from?
Well, he's clever. I think that's one of the main things about him. But he doesn't quite know why or what to do with this intelligence. He comes from quite a kind of dysfunctional family, and the book really starts when he's 16, and he just comes across some very kind of committed people who really kind of believe passionately in putting the world to rights, really. And I think once he gets into this place and he meets a very remarkable man, he sort of clings to that. He really needs, you know, it's that paradoxical position that he thinks he wants to change everything around him, but in fact he really wants to cling to what he has, even though what he has is not really that substantial. So I liked him. Sometimes when you're writing a book in somebody's voice, you're interested by them, but you're not necessarily sure that you like them. But Spike, there was lots about Spike that I actually really did like.
So he's growing up in the early 80s, and it's unnamed, but it's obviously Sheffield, which is hometown. So what are your memories of this? Was, you know, the time of the early 80s, so Margaret Thatcher was in the ascendance, you know, the era of the Falklands War and the miners' strike were just either just happening or about to happen. What was your memory of these type of Marxist, Spartacist?
Well, the Spartacists, they were a real group, and there were all sorts of little far left groups just operating in their own way. They used to, you know, have these small scale hand printed newspapers or free sheets or whatever. They would stand on the steps of Sheffield City Libraries selling copies and really engaging in political argument with anybody who came along. And, you know, when I was 16, they were an object of real fascination to me. They seemed so kind of knowledgeable. They seemed to understand how the world really was and to offer an explanation. The Spartacists were quite extreme, even by the standards of the time. And some of them actually believed, for instance, that that a nuclear war would not be a bad idea. I think ultimately because they thought that, you know, mass destruction would destroy capitalist society, and then some kind of workers' paradise could arise from the ashes or something like that. Certainly, they very strongly believed in the right of the Soviet Union to defend itself by any means necessary. So they did used to go along and break up CND meetings, which they do in the book. And the thing that I rather liked about them at the time was that, you know, before social media, before, you know, all this connectivity, you could say anything you liked, really, you know, however outrageous an opinion was, and it wouldn't get that far. So people were much freer, I think, then to play with extreme ideas and extreme propositions. It seemed like a very kind of exciting kind of melting pot, really, of a melting pot of ideas. You never knew what somebody was going to say quite seriously next, and you know, and they, and you know, just embark on some argument with you that might last for hours or days.
Tell us about some of the other characters in the small group that Spike becomes fascinated with then. Percy Ogden, James Frinton and Tracy Cartwright particularly, I'd like to say something about.
One of the things that I've noticed in life is that very intelligent and remarkable people, they never really come singly. They always come in kind of groups of, they've kind of egged each other on and encouraged each other from early on. And Percy Ogden is a boy who, a boy at school who is very authoritative. He has absolutely no respect for authority at all. And that was taken from a friend of mine at school who did pretty well exactly what Percy Ogden does in the book, that I went to the sort of school that occasionally recruitment officers from the army would come along and tell you all about the wonderfulness of the army. And at the end of it, the talk, my friend stood up and said, how can you reconcile your conscience with working for an imperialist fascist organization? So it was very much like that. Percy Ogden sort of doesn't fulfill his potential, let's say. You know, he ends up pontificating in newspapers. He'd really like to be running the world. James Frinton is a kind of odd one. He's sort of isolated from the rest of the group in a way, and he really does become something. What he wants to achieve, he doesn't really share with the others. And then there's poor Tracy. Tracy is the girl who is just passionate about everything, really. She just loves being in this group. She loves ideas, but she loves the argument. She loves people, and she comes to she goes on a particular journey that doesn't end particularly well.
And I guess the first stage of this group starting to sort of turn their back on their former idealism and you know, make compromises with the future is a number of them are together at Oxford. And I mean, I know you've written about your own experiences there, about the, you know, the whole idea of going and having this opportunity to reinvent yourself as a different person. But there's also, I guess, not only the, you know, the personal option to decide to become somebody else, but also, I guess, is this idea of Oxbridge as a sort of factory for training the next generation of the ruling classes. So I guess there's a way there as well in which the sort of, in some ways, the eccentricities of these characters are knocked out of them through that process.
Well, maybe, though, you know, the you know, there was an eccentricity within the process of becoming a the next generation of ruling classes. I don't know whether it's always like that at Oxford, but it was certainly very much like that when I was there. There was a sense that, you know, this political debate was going to produce prime ministers. And it did. You know, Boris was in my year. Boris was a very kind of conspicuous figure in Oxford at the time. Everybody knew who he was. I think that what seems to be happening to most people when they go to university is that most people have left the people that know about their history behind, and for once you could do or say anything you like without any kind of consequences. Particularly, you know, in at that time, I knew all sorts of people who would turn up and actually they would change their names, or, you know, start to talk in a completely different way, or actually, you know, change their entire kind of political philosophy. And people sort of accepted it. I mean, though it was, of course, people would sometimes laugh about it, but it was a time of kind of radical reinvention in all sorts of ways.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Philip Henscher, and we're talking about his latest novel, A Small Revolution in Germany. And Philip, earlier on you talked about how much you like Spike as a character, and there's a theme in the book about, you know, the idea of compromise, not changing one's idealism, and how unusual that is. And I've been interested to see, I want to talk about the sort of reception to the book, because it seems to me it depends on who is reading it, who is reviewing it, as to how they see that sort of passage. And Spike himself talks in the book about whether or not he might have wasted his life, and certainly the other characters around him achieve in different degrees of material success. They often have to compromise quite severely in some cases to achieve that, whereas Spike himself, while he hasn't changed his ideas, he has a perfectly solid job, and more importantly, he's made a lifelong commitment to the love of his life, which seems to be an absolutely successful life.
Yes, I think so, yes. Well, it was, I mean, the reviews that I read, some of them seemed to think that it was their job to decide whether they were on Spike's side or not, or whether they should be supporting Spike in his decision or denouncing him. And I didn't really see that as my job at all. I don't really know whether I think that Spike did the right thing, because, you know, how would you say that about your closest and dearest friends? It's a sort of journey that he goes on, that it is a possible journey to go on. And I just wanted to show really what the consequences of that might be for an individual or human being.
There's a couple of significant trips in the book to East Germany as it was, and then much later on, the former East Germany. We'll talk about the later trip later on, and I know in the last couple of years you've travelled yourself quite extensively and in that sort of area. The central trip to the former East Germany, while it was still under the it was still the DDR, and there are some significant events that happen in Spike's life on this trip. Did you ever visit at that time yourself?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about researching that part of the trip, but tell us your own recollections of visiting the DDR.
Well, it's something that I really wish now that I'd done more of while it was there. But of course, you don't realise that at the time that this is going to disappear. I think the thing that it's sort of difficult to it's quite difficult to remember, because of course people have talked about it to me so much afterwards. You know, it's quite difficult to separate now my kind of immediate kind of impressions of being in the DDR in the late 80s from the kind of explanations that have kind of followed in really large amounts. I think what I really do have a very strong impression of was the utter transformation of everything when you went from one side of the border to the other. What it looked like, what it smelt like, the way people related to you, the food and the kind of practicalities, and actually the sort of speed of everything, really. That's my overwhelming sense, that it just seemed somewhere that things were happening much more slowly and somehow much more sparsely. But the explanations of why that was, I remember being kind of puzzled by these places at the time, and there's been such floods of explanation of what it was like to live there, to experience it, that I'm not sure that I really kind of I really know how to talk about it anymore. It was certainly a very kind of challenging place in ways that were quite difficult to pin down. You know, why do I find it so kind of difficult just kind of walking down a street and looking at buildings? It just seemed impossible to explain. But I know that everyone that I traveled there with felt quite similar.
And so what was it like to revisit it many years later?
Well, it was wonderful, because of course you could switch it off. No, it was really tremendous. And actually, I've gone back to, you know, those parts of Germany a lot since, and it is a kind of an evocative experience. And trying to get back this completely lost, these completely lost sense of what it was like. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. And there's, you know, the research for it, such that it was really kind of richly enjoyable. But as I say, you know, you can switch it off and walk away from it if it's you know, if you're writing a book about it.
And so, did you visit the former border area that Spike takes a sort of walking trip along in the book?
I did. You know, it did recently in 5 years. I don't think you wouldn't have been allowed anywhere near it then. The part of Germany that they go to, the Harz Mountains, the Brocken, the big mountain, or big-ish mountains, about 1,000 meters high, that was only opened up to the public after the fall of the wall, and it was it's a tragic thing, because it's absolutely central to German culture. There's one of the acts of Faust, Part Two, Goethe's Faust, is set there. And I've been told, I don't know whether it's true, but the night that the wall fell, 100,000 people walked up the Brocken So it was. It's an extraordinary part of Germany. It's not much visited by foreigners, and certainly that bit of the border that is kind of preserved, and you can walk along the where the wall ran, is one of the most magical bits of. One of the most magical bits of countryside now, with the occasional kind of reminiscence of the DDR, like a watchtower. It's a very, very strange and evocative place.
To finish it off, then, can I get you to read a bit?
Of course. Well, I think I might. I think I might read the bit where Spike meets Joaquin for the. For the first time, and it's really kind of love at first sight thing. I did enjoy Joaquin. Would you ever go back to Chile? I said. I could see Joaquin at the head of an army of widows, orphans, exiles, revolutionaries, standing in a hurtling jeep in the hot sun, hurtling under arches of white bougainvillea and hibiscus, his arms outspread. In acknowledgement and welcome. Chile? No, Joaquin said, bright with hilarity. That is over for me. Someone else can deal with it. Put it right. What I have to do is here and now. You know what I mean? What astonished me was to discover that Joaquin and I were exactly the same height. He had seemed so big and so physically substantial with bone and hard flesh. I hardly knew how to place myself in relation to that physical scale. It was only now that I discovered our faces were in the same place, exactly level, 6 feet above the concrete floor of the balcony where marigolds, scarlet geraniums, marijuana plants, purple, pink, aquamarine and yellow snapdragons sat in pots one warm evening within the all-including rich masculine smell of Joaquin, the revolutionary. Joaquin's kiss, when it came, was a fact of inevitable nature, like a warm front predicted on the news bulletin and then experienced without surprise, recognised rather, a fact quite external to our characters. I had no idea, or not much, that it was in me to kiss a 22-year-old Chilean Spartacist until it was actually happening, and once it started, I had a moment of shock, almost alarm, that I am a male and I am being kissed by another male. Before a more certain and individual sense that I was meant to be kissed like this, with the solid arms around my back and shoulders, the thick trunk of the tongue in my mouth, pushing back at my own tongue, the rough rub of Joaquin's face against mine, and I knew my right hand gripping the short curly hair on the flat back of Joaquin's head. His odour was all around me. I closed my eyes and was within it. I had kissed girls before, but I had never, it now seemed, been kissed. Everything in the world that was soft and tentative, pink, blushing and yielding, was gone from my life in a moment. I had no idea where I found myself in this new world of definite statements and solid certainty. I had no idea where I was. From now on, I resolved to devote my life to the liberation of the urban proletariat. Joaquin pulled back for a moment, his arms still around me. His beautiful face was filled with laughter and amused joy. The way you were looking at me, he said, and he plunged once more at my face.
I've been talking to Philip Henscher. We've been talking about his latest novel, A Small Revolution in Germany, which is out now from Fourth Estate in the UK. Philip, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.